Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 38 of Season 7 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1995 Bruce Willis action flick, Die Hard with a Vengeance, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is my good friend Heather Baxendale from Word of Hellmouth. Welcome back to the show, Heather.
Hello, Rob. Thank you
bro,
for having me back.
My bro.
Yeah, we're bros. That's what's up. Now
exactly.
We're broke for life.
The 5,000 mile away fist
bump. Hey, those are the best. Because one day we will meet in person. Maybe we won't. But if we do, we are definitely bro fist bumping.
There you go. So, minute 38 begins with Zeus making an offer to the cop and ends with the bomb in the box getting ready to explode.
What's in the box?
Yeah. What's in the box? What's in the box?
Everybody saw what was in the box.
Actually, I like what's in the box here more than what's in the box in 7.
Oh, geez, me too.
So there you go.
Me too. Every time. It's in my top 5 movies of all time, and still gets me. That's why it's in my top 5 movies of all time.
I think that's part of the plan. That's what they want.
It was effective. Yes.
And from that perspective, it works.
And it's made a great joke.
What can I
say? Like this.
Yeah, that is definitely true. All right. So yesterday we ended things with Zeus having to deal with, trying to answer a phone and, having a little bit of trouble with it because someone's holding a gun on him for some strange, very strange reason. Again, I'm still a little shocked at the stupidity of this transit cop. You don't pull a gun on somebody just because they actually jumped the turnstiles. Agree?
Oh yeah.
I mean, if it was going according to what we talked about in the script, if we were talking about what was in the script where he has a gun, okay.
Yeah.
I can sort of understand that, but there's even if Zeus has a gun, we don't know he has a gun.
This is true. There's nothing that, he's done nothing up to this point other than jump a turnstile, which bad form, Peter, but that's all he's done. And now he's being aggressive with another person. He's making him leave the phone, but he hasn't actually done anything certainly worthy of pulling a firearm. And officers are not supposed to.
He was rude. He was rude to the business.
Oh my gosh. Do you know how many times I've had officers pull firearms on me for being rude to people? Particularly in places like this and scenarios such as minus all the terrorist stuff. Yeah, I would be shot in jail, all sorts of things, because the second the gun would be pulled on me, I'd start running my mouth too. However, Zeus here is being quite calm and authoritative with his delivery. And it's very impressive. But also,
yes.
I mean, and that's the thing about his shaky hand and him being nervous here too, our transit cop, that makes him extremely and wildly unpredictable. Even trying to talk him down is not really something that you can do in this short period of time. And that's what we have built up at this point, is they have to act right now. Both McClane and Zeus, they don't have the luxury of time. They don't have the luxury of talking this guy down. They don't have the luxury of following rules. They just got to get it done. And this cop here, we have no idea what he's going to do because of that. And obviously he's a loose cannon.
It adds a little bit of tension to the scene.
To some degree.
Yes. Yes. I think it's more believable that it would happen now than necessarily in 1995.
Yeah. Well, we have a lot of
phones
now that have recorded a lot of things that have been incriminating to cops that are not good. So we know that things like this do happen, and they're not just whispers or rumors or little articles that get shoved aside either. So it definitely is. But there was also heightened, this is mid-90s too, so there was more West Coast heightened, I would say, awareness of police brutality than East Coast at this point. But I think it's still traveled across the country. So just like there's some lines they're definitely towing in this movie, considering the timeline. I'm not mad about it at all. It's relevant. It's being used, but that's what we do in storytelling. It's definitely a plot device.
Correct. But I think also partially, 6 years after this movie came out, once 9/11 happened, the world changed, especially in New York. What about these things? So I think that also is something that makes us look at this in 1995 and say, okay, this is an overreaction. But anything after 2001, you're like, okay, that's not an overreaction. That's what it comes down
Oh,
to.
absolutely, particularly the terrorist
Which is,
stuff.
that's right. Which is really hard to watch these type of movies and put ourselves back into the mind frame of pre-9/11.
Yeah, it is. And it's interesting too, because we can ask people that have seen it, that saw it afterwards and didn't see it before that, how they feel about it. I don't know. How do these movies make you feel? That sometimes they work for me, and sometimes they definitely make me uncomfortable, which isn't the
Well, which
intention.
movies? You're talking specifically about this movie, or you're talking about like what is your when you say
I
what?
would say like this, movies that happened pre-9/11, that have some kind of, we use a lot of terrorist stuff then, and they're popcorn flicks. They're not made to sit there and really make any kind of political point or worldview point. They're not doing this in the
Right.
movie. Like I said, it's a plot device. It works very well, but now we look back and it feels, sometimes I'm like, oh, I'm a little insensitive about this after everything our country and other countries have suffered, and we use it as,
That's correct.
so and that aspect of it, I do feel a little uncomfortable and nudge myself sometimes for enjoying it, and yet I'm also like, it's a popcorn flick. And we also watch
That's
Roland
right.
Emmerich
Have
movies
you?
about the world being destroyed all the time, you
That's
know.
correct. And they're those are fun.
Yes,
You
they shouldn't be, and yet they are, and that's kind of the point I'm getting to, I think.
That's right. Correct. No, but have you ever seen the movie The Siege with Denzel Washington and Annette Bening?
Yes.
Okay, that's a movie that, first of all, would never be made today.
Agreed.
No question about that. But that's a difficult one to watch because it, in some ways, it seems somewhat prophetic about how things can go. And that came out in '98, so that came out 3 years
Oh,
before
that's right.
9/11.
That's right.
And look, so, and I mean, again, looking at everything that's going on today in 2024, you're like, oh my God, how close was the general idea? Obviously not where they took the story, but I'm just saying in general, the idea that you don't know what's going to happen, and when you're dealing with a terrorist situation, like in this movie, or actually in any of the original Die Hard trilogy, okay, none of the terrorists are what we would call today terrorists.
No. Exactly.
Forgetting about the fact that two of them are just thieves, and the third one is just someone who wants to start a revolution. Those are the whole thing. But you don't think of when you think today in 2024 of the word terrorist, you do not think of people from South America,
Nope.
from a fake country in South America that want to regain power, and you don't think of German brothers, who are not really terrorists,
Oh yeah.
but they
But
pretend
it
to
was
be.
like such a common thread that we went through, particularly in the 90s. I mean, we have Lethal Weapon 2, True Lies, they're all sensationalized. And again, it's all on that cusp of entertainment. I think you're right. I think since 9/11, we see a lot more conscientious choices being made for films where the villains are terrorists. Some of them are still exploitive and fun like this. But we see a lot less of these now, a lot less.
Yes. Well, because people are scared to make movies like this.
It's understandable
Because
because we don't know how people will
they don't want to
react.
get sued.
They don't want to get
They
sued. They
don't
don't
want
want
to
to offend the audience. I mean, there's so many things. I mean, if it's done right, I'll laugh at anything. I have the most dark sense of humor that there is, but it has to be done in some
Exactly.
capacity. That's all. You just have to be
Yes.
good
But
for
again, I
yourself.
mean,
That's all.
Right, but when you want to talk about comedies, I mean, look at comedies from the 70s and 80s, TV shows and movies. How many of those, even 90s, how many of them would the current culture in the world say, oh, that's not funny anymore. You can't make jokes like that. And you know, and those shows and movies were fun back then.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Mark and I are doing a podcast right now that is essentially that, where we're going over Buffy 25 years later and going, okay, we're putting our adult goggles on and looking at this differently and looking at the social perspectives of it and looking at how we saw things then and how they compare to now and how the show did grow and how some things were not so great about it that we thought were fine at the time, or we felt like, that used to bother me and I didn't know why. And now that I'm an adult, I understand why there was a problem with this character in this situation.
No, but you're talking about stuff from a PC perspective, or you're talking about it from,
I would say evolving from a moral perspective as people in general, just particularly, I mean, this isn't going to surprise everyone, but from a Joss Whedon perspective, who is now known as being quite the nasty, nasty man.
Okay, well, there's too many of those in the Hollywood
exactly
community.
But specifically this one, we're looking at the way that female characters specifically being the heroes in that kind of way, the way that they were treated then, and women's places in society even then is very different than it is now. You know, slang, terms that we use, there are jokes about people being gay. On a show that actually really, really, again, there's so many contradictions in Buffy in general, but in a show that, you know, addressed and really did it, one of the first really well done jobs of a gay relationship between two women. They started off making really, really, really bad jokes in regards to that kind of thing. It's all the time. We see it now, but we can go, I think the point I'm getting to here is, let my neurodivergent brain bring it back. I think the point is we can look back and go, oh yeah, that was of the time. And yes, it makes me feel uncomfortable now, but we're doing it differently now. And we understand that this was a product of its time and that doesn't make everything awful and bad.
Okay. So you're saying it's like steroids in baseball.
What in baseball?
Steroids.
Oh, steroids in baseball. Yeah. Or even, weightlifting, like Arnold has been completely honest about the fact that he used steroids for a while. I was like, yeah, we all were. Yeah, we were. No, yeah. It's bad. We don't do that now. But yeah, at the time, that was just what everybody was doing. So that's what we did. So sure. Yeah. And steroids in baseball, that's a perfect example of going, oh, okay, well, you know, we can't compare the players the same because of that, but we can still look at it on a broader spectrum and understand where it's going.
Right.
Change. And I think that's the same concept here with these kinds of movies. We can True. Cringe. We can cringe. It's okay to cringe and go, oh, oh no, that's not good. Like this copier. Like, come on. We're cringing. But it makes sense, and it makes sense in the timeline, and it makes sense there. And it makes a heck of a lot more sense. And I think it's way more tense because it's we did take the gun out of Sam Jackson's hands. I think that changed Right. everything here and made the scene a million times better than what it would have been.
Yes. Completely agree with you on that. Okay, so let's actually start talking about the minutes.
Sorry, there we go. And this is why we always have
long no need to apologize. Heather, no need to apologize. That's why it's always fun recording with you. So we ended things yesterday with Zeus trying to calm the policeman down, but he still wanted to answer the phone. And he says, if you have to shoot me, then go ahead and shoot me. But I have to answer this phone, all right? Now, I love his intonation here. Again, we briefly touched on it yesterday. It is definitely his Jules Winfrey intonation with the way that he's saying it.
Yes, but he looks like Arnold from Jurassic Park here because it's very close to that timeline. So, especially yes. with the white shirt. So I'm like, true. Oh, he's got some administrative and whatnot vibes, but it's also very much Jules. It's the timeline.
But he's got two arms, so it can't be him.
No, that's just sad, but also accurate.
Yes, that's right.
But yeah, both those films came out around this time too, so it's not surprising that he's vibing.
Oh, it's 2 years before. Jurassic Park came out in 93. This is 95.
Yep. All right, perfect.
You know, and we actually just found out last week what year this movie takes place, and we'll talk about it as we go through over the next few days. We'll come across that again to get an idea. I think tomorrow. We'll get a better idea of when this is theoretically taken place? I mean, we've had a lot of questions raised over the last 37 episodes as to when this takes place, because, you know, in the one of the very first shots in the movie, we see a back to school sale sign. Okay, but we also know that it's very hot.
Yeah,
it does not feel like it's September. You know, so it's not. So
maybe August.
It
end of August.
But why would all the kids have been in school?
Some kids go back to school in August. I've learned this over.
No, but it doesn't. It doesn't seem as if when they're showing the schools, it doesn't seem as if they're just getting back to, you know, that they've started classes recently.
Okay.
It doesn't seem that way. Again, we're not 100% sure. You know, so the question really is when does this take place? And we don't have a definitive answer. You know, the assumption is it's sometime probably like late May, early June 1995. But again, we'll get back there possibly tomorrow. Excellent. And at this point, Zeus decides to take the chance because this phone keeps ringing, and he slowly picks it up. And then he answers the phone and says, "I'm here." And then we hear Simon's voice.
He's got such great eyes here. He's got the Sam eyes here. Like, are you gonna F with me? Are you gonna shoot me? Because I'm answering the phone. He's testing him because he's planning on doing it no matter what. And this is one of those moments where the dialogue is fine, but Sam Jackson definitely elevates it. He's great.
Yeah, because also like when he picks up the phone, he like points the phone at the cop who's shaking, you know, just showing him, this is what I'm doing.
Yep.
This is it. Don't worry. Don't shoot me. I'm just picking up the phone. And then we hear Simon's voice over the line saying, "And McLean?" And then he says, "He's on his way. You know, he's a little slow. He's kind of out of shape." which is such a great on the spur type of answer.
Freaking hilarious. You know? And it breaks the tension, too. I love lines like that.
Now, that's right. Do you think that line is in the script?
No, I feel like that's Sam.
All right, we'll find out.
We will. No,
I'm not going to give it away now.
I love being right.
I'm not going to give it.
So I want to know.
Well, we'll have to wait and find out.
Forget. So it'll be fun. Now it'll be a surprise. See?
There you go. And then Simon says, "The rules apply to both of you. I'm afraid this is non-compliance. Goodbye." And this is before AOL became popular. You know, you've got mail. Goodbye.
Oh, yeah. Or you are the weakest link. Goodbye.
That's right. Well, that's a long time afterwards.
Yeah,
also.
That's a bit after. Oh, and I love that right after he gets off the phone, too, his reaction. Well, I guess this is it now. The calm resolve and acceptance.
That's right. He doesn't even try and argue with him. He just figures that's the way it is. And he just like, you know, drops the receiver more or less and starts getting into like the duck and cover position or a brace position or whatever you want to call it. You know, just to keep himself a little safer, even though he has no idea what's theoretically supposed to be coming.
No.
You know, he hears the goodbye and that's it.
He has no idea if the plane's gotten to the bomb. He has no idea how big the bomb is or what's going to happen. Or, yeah, this is completely unpredictable from his side. But that gun that rookie cop is aiming at him certainly isn't the biggest fish he's facing at all.
No. No, not at all. Did you notice that Simon didn't say Simon Says?
I did. I did there.
So I guess he turned the game off for a little while.
I think the game is whatever he wants it to be, and that's usually how these things go. But he is pretty meticulous.
Yeah, usually.
So I think I just probably do everything he said anyway.
Right.
Just in case.
And as Zeus is like creeping towards the ground, he turns to both the cop and the businessman and goes, "Trust me, guys, duck."
And they just start looking at him like he's crazy. But I mean, you're like, I always think in these movies because we're watching it from the main character's perspectives. I always go, I get so frustrated with people that aren't doing what they're supposed to do or what I feel like I would do in this scenario. I'm like, why aren't you listening to him? But then really think about it and put yourself in the situation of some guy was at a payphone threatening another guy. And he's acting like a crazy person. He really is.
That's right.
However, the police officer should be trained to deal with such situations for the regular, especially in a city like New York.
Okay, but again, he's a rookie, so he hasn't reached that level of training yet, I guess.
No. I've actually been pulled over and just for a regular traffic thing. I ran your plates and blah blah blah. And this guy was freaking out. I could tell he was a noob. But I was in the car with my kids and he's coming up, he's got like handwriting on his holster. I've been pulled over a lot in my life. Marginally because I worked at a bar for about 10 years. So I got pulled over driving home from work all the time because it was bar o'clock is what I called it. But I've been pulled over a lot anyway. And I've never had an officer act like that. And it was broad daylight and I had pulled into a bank and he was acting like he was going to pull his gun at any moment. He was scared. He was really scared. And I had empathy for him. But at the same time, you know, that's such a weird transition to have to make from being a civilian into that role. Every car you come up to, you don't know what's going to happen. So again,
Correct.
legitimacy to it, but I still want to throw a rock at his head because I'm in Sam Jackson's side.
I have a feeling that that will not help you.
No, it won't.
No, won't help the situation. Then they give us a shot of the train coming into the station, more or less. We get a few seconds of that, and then they give us a great shot of the undercarriage of the train also, and then we're back in inside the train itself, and we have John at the back of the train, trying to somehow open the back door. Now we th there's two posters on the wall here. One of them we talked about last week about the Goodwill Games, 1994 Goodwill Games, which
I remember those.
I mean, I know we said that tomorrow we'll get more into the fact of when this is possibly taking place, but we talked about this last week that the odds are the Goodwill Games haven't happened yet in 1994. So this movie probably takes place in 1994 because you'd think that they would, because if the Goodwill Games were July 23rd to August 7th, as it's stated on the poster, so the odds are that this happened beforehand. So this is probably mid-June, something like that. But
Yeah.
again, tomorrow we'll talk a little more about that also.
Well, still too. Okay, so we're seeing you see a lot of stuff that is back to school things, but kids are in school.
Correct. No, we were very confused. That was back in like the second or third episode where Jay talked about that with me, and we didn't it didn't make any sense that that was there.
No.
Because it's not August or anything like that. Now, did you see the poster on the left-hand side? Did you see what it says?
It says it looks like some kind of art, and then there are words that I can't read. It looks like the city something core. That's what I
The
have.
City Volunteer Corps. It's the City Volunteer Corps, and it says if you're between 17 and 25, call, and then it gives you the phone number. And then it says, stay at home, change the world.
What?
So I actually tried looking that up to find out what it is. What is the City Volunteer Corps? Because it's a strange thing that they're looking for people between the ages of 17 and 25. Like, it sounds very young
Yeah.
to want people there. We're not talking about something that someone who's much older or anything like that.
They're
I
recruiting young
understand, like
and
if it was the Peace
easier
Corps or
to
something like
influence
that.
young people. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's why
Yeah,
you go
so I mean
after
it's,
younger
it's
people. You go after them because they're easier to influence. They're not fully cooked yet.
correct, but why would you go after a 17-year-old who's supposed to be in school?
Yeah, I don't know. Like all
That's what I'm saying. It's like, maybe they expect people to have, gotten out of school already by that point.
Or maybe they're
I don't
recruiting
know.
people that didn't finish their high school experience. Maybe.
Those are the people you want to volunteer to change the world?
Maybe
I don't
depending on what it is. Hey, I'm just throwing stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks. Because obviously it's not thinking from a traditional perspective in order to recruit, if that's the case. Although some people
Right.
graduated and are 17. I was 17 when I started college. So I was 16 my senior year in high school for the first 3 or 4 months.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, that does happen. It does happen. It's not as regular, right. I mean, but it does happen. So it's possible.
Okay. So the official name is the New York City Volunteer Corps, and its abbreviation is the CVC. What year do you think they started this program?
1936.
1984. So I've been around for 10 years at this point.
I didn't get to the 80s with my first guest on the first episode. I need to stay in the 1980s for the rest of them. Okay, so 1986. Oh, hey, if they are looking for volunteers.
1984.
Okay.
So it is the nation's. There you go. It's the nation's largest urban youth service corps. It has numerous goals, just like many youth groups. The idea of community service and youth development, but it's very distinctive. Among the various youth corps, because they pioneered the large-scale use of corps members in delivering human services to homeless, elderly, disabled, and other dependent populations. They also enable their members to pursue mainstream academic credentials during their service, and they give them either $2,500 in cash or a scholarship for school after they've done this for a year. Other unique aspects of the CVC include its emphasis on service to the city rather than on employment and training. Its definition of core members as volunteers who receive stipends, its non-residential program design, and the city's commitment to provide virtually all the Corps' financial support. The CVC appears to be well-positioned at the end of its startup phase to build on its initial progress, and they have, within the first, I think this was... first 5 years, they were able to provide nearly 500,000 hours of service within the city. You know, and again, this is all volunteer.
That's amazing. And those are really good incentives, yeah, too. And that actually would make sense for a kid who maybe wasn't going to college or didn't graduate to come back and maybe work on something like a GED or decide to go to college, even if it's something like community college or something like that. That's really great.
And the first year, quote unquote, class of members, they had 674 people who had signed up for it.
Wow. Well, that's a lovely thing to find out about.
Yeah, and most of them are from lower social classes. The statistics that I have here is that within that first year, 75% were African Americans. 21% were Hispanic Americans, and 2% were whites, were Caucasians.
That does not surprise me in the slightest.
Yeah. Okay, but again, it's a great program. I'm trying to think of who was the mayor in 84. Was it still? Okay. I wonder if it was still Ed Koch. I think it was still Ed Koch at the time.
In the 90s? In the mid
90s? No, 84, 84.
Oh, I was going to say, I don't think in the 90s. Yeah, 84.
No,
yeah.
94. At this point, I think it was already Giuliani.
Yeah, yeah.
In 94.
So. I think, yeah, he had been for a while by the late 90s. So, yeah, I think you're right. That sounds
good. Yeah.
We'll say you're correct. Yes, unless anyone would like to let us know otherwise in the comments. This is a fact.
There you go.
This is a...
And John tries to break the window, not very effectively.
Which,
you know, he actually doesn't look
kind of a problem
because if he's giving enough
break
power
windows with his feet, no less, his bare feet, he can break
with his feet, with his feet, but not with his arm.
No,
you know, that's what he should be doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the shot changes. That's right. Apparently, wrong franchise, but yes.
Yeah, but they're cousins. They're family cousin franchises.
Yes. But we know that they don't take place in the same universe. That's what we know.
Yeah.
Because in Die Hard 2, someone was reading a magazine which had an ad for Lethal Weapon. Lethal Weapon 2.
Well, I mean, that's kind of cool that they did have a magazine with the ad, but I really like the idea of them living in the same universe together.
Yes. Because we had a theory. I think it was Mark? I think it was Mark Hoffmeyer who was my guest that we were talking about the possibility of there being triplets, you know, because you had oh, what's his name? One of the terrorists from Die Hard, who was also in Lethal Weapon. I can picture him right now. I'm trying to remember his name.
Was he a
He was
henchman?
also in Big Trouble in Little, the henchman, of course.
The henchman.
Oh, what the hell is his name? I know that there are people yelling at their phones right now. Probably Jay also saying, "Oh, it's on the tip of my oh, crap."
Damn it, Jay, tell me. I don't have it. Jay, text me right now and let me know. I have to know. And I don't want to look it up myself because I'm old. And it's so funny because that's what I yell at my kids for all the time. I'm like, you guys grew up with phones in your hand. Why don't you
okay,
look things up?
There you go. Okay, I got it. Al Leong. He played Uli in Die Hard, and then he played the torture guy in Lethal Weapon.
Oh yeah.
And he was also in Big Trouble in Little China. So we talked about the fact that he was that they were triplets, you know, because they all appeared. But then, you know, once we thought about it, we said, wait a second. If they have an ad, it can't be in the same universe. So.
No, I just pooped in my Cheerios. It's fine.
Yeah, basically.
Darn fact.
Right. And then we get a shot of people waiting for the train. We see like this woman in a dress who looks really bored.
Not for
yeah, just
long.
Waiting for that train. You know. And
well,
then
they're
back.
Yeah.
That's right. We're back with John, who is still trying to get this door open. He decides that he's going to try and kick it, but because he's wearing shoes, it's not going to work. You know, you need to be barefoot, John McClane, in order to do it. But he does manage to break through it. You know, and the window shatters, and then they give us a great shot of the train. You know, pass. You know, the train track, and we see a little wire on the train track.
Yes.
That basically the train goes over,
and it detonates.
You know, and then it's connected to something that starts you know, flashing and beeping. You know, which obviously that means that something's going on, and then John takes the call box and throws it out the window that he just broke. And as it's flying in midair, we see it a big flash, and then the minute ends.
Yeah.
So it's I gotta say when I was doing my research on this minute, I thought it was so cool that is how this minute ends.
I did too. I went when I like I said, I watched the movie a couple of days ago. And then I went through and I went and watched all the minutes separately. And then at the end of that one, I'm like, that never works out like that. Never that cool. It was like perfect for a commercial break.
Yes, that's right. All right. And that's all I have for this minute. Do you have anything else?
I just think I love really, really tight action sequences like this. And because of your shows, I've watched a lot and broken them down. And I love seeing how tight they are. And why they work so well as opposed to ones that fail and don't work as well. Mm-hmm. And you don't have the same emotional connection because, I mean, it is a popcorn flick. And yes, we're talking about serious stuff in it. But at the same time, this movie is entirely created for entertainment, not reflection. But it doesn't, but we don't care about the characters, then it doesn't really matter. So we like
Correct.
The two main characters. We're already invested in McClane. Zeus is a cool guy. We already know he's a good guy and we like him. But we're also putting all these other characters in peril. So we don't.
Like the bored woman standing and waiting for the train.
Yes. And all the people that were on the train that McClane's running through too. So we have all these pedestrians that are just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And then you have all of this built up like, okay, well, no matter what this looks like, it's going to fail. So at this point, what is the scale of the failure? What is that fallout going to look like? And then what's going to happen after this? Because obviously it's going to escalate. So it's like all this great momentum building steps, and they're all little things, but together they make this big picture perfect. And it's great.
Yeah.
One of the things that makes this movie so great is because it is the pacing. It is all of those little details. And
yes.
I don't think necessarily a lot of directors, especially action, don't always take the time to make sure all of those things work.
That's right. I agree with you. All right, so let's get into the script a little bit. So it starts off this minute by saying, he sets the plastique on the seat and jerks the door handle. It's jammed. McLean strains, looks at his watch. It's exactly 5:20. Remember, again, they're talking. It takes place in the afternoon as opposed to the morning. He strains with all his might. It won't open. It cuts to the subway station platform. The cop is patting down Zeus's leg, frisking him. The phone rings again. The fifth ring. The sixth. Zeus's right hand plastered against the wall, inches towards the phone receiver. He grabs it off the cradle, whips around, and smashes it against the cop's temple. The cop goes down, writhing in pain, his revolver falling on the platform. Zeus grabs the gun and trains it on the cop, holding him at bay. The phone is dangling from its metal cord. Zeus grabs it and shouts into it, "Yeah, I'm here." After a pause, "Yes, you are. But where is McLean?" "He couldn't make it. The rules were you both had to be there. You have to learn to follow instructions. I'm afraid this is non-compliance. Goodbye." "Simon, wait." Click. Zeus looks at the phone in terror and turns. The first car of the train emerges from the tunnel. Zeus cowers in anticipation of the explosion. "Get down." The businessman and the transit cop look at Zeus, confused, as if he's a lunatic. The subway car is entering the station. We focus on the wheels of the car inching towards an electronic detonator attached to the subway track. It's a wire stretched across the rail, connecting two circuit breakers. The passing of the first subway car will cut the wire and thus trigger the detonator. The last car of the subway train, McLean gives up on the door handle. He thrusts his elbow through the glass window of the subway door. He grips the bundle of plastique and flings it through the smashed aperture in the window. The plastique falls on the tracks, and McLean dives forward, sliding across the car's floor to the other end of the car. He covers up, but nothing happens. McLean, confused, uncovers and looks around as the wheels of the first car roll over the wire of the detonator, breaking the circuit. The detonator flashes, sending a signal to, and then it ends. Yeah. So I gotta say, I don't really like the way that they do it here.
No.
I don't like the fact that Zeus has to, what's the term? Where he just bashes the phone in the cop's head, yeah, and then takes his gun.
Yeah, he assaults him.
Yeah.
I mean, it's assault on a police officer. Yeah, I think that's why they took it out, and I'm glad they did, because that would make him less sympathetic. The cop might be behaving inappropriately, but he's still just doing his job. And we don't need that level of escalation between the two of them. So, yeah.
Very true.
I like that is not happening either.
I like how in the script they explain how the explosives get triggered. I like how that's explained there. Whether it's true or not of how it works about breaking the circuit and all that stuff, I don't know. I'm not a bomb expert. Did you ask your bomb expert friend about these things? Like we said that you would. See, you don't do your homework.
I do my homework most of the time. I had to fight bad guys last night. So I was helping the greater good. I was stopping an invasion from another planet and aliens. It was important work.
Okay.
Somebody's got to do it, right?
Okay. All right. Now I'll give you that one for that one.
But yeah, I think it's, I like details like that. I think that stuff's really cool. I don't necessarily think that all audiences do or want any of those details. And I think kind of what we were just saying too, is the pacing of this is so smart and so well done. That leaving out some details and showing more shots, like actually showing rather than telling has worked much better for this movie in particular. I think it works significantly better.
Yeah. The editing here is great also.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tight. It's so tight. This entire like little 1 minute block that we're discussing today, I'm thoroughly impressed with it from start to finish. There's so much that was achieved here. And reading the script now and seeing what they changed in it and upgraded and did better, I'm really, really impressed.
Yeah, I agree. All right, so every Wednesday we have a segment called Jesus Hump Day, where my guests will give their top five Samuel L. Jackson performances. So, Heather, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Yeah, this is really hard because he's been in like 300 movies and they're all so good. Well, most of them are good, not all of them, but his performances are always good. So I just picked my favorites and the ones that came to me first. The first thing I thought of, and I know some people aren't fond of the movie, but I love Black Snake Moan and him as Lazarus in it. He's phenomenal. As far as performance goes, he's incredible in it. It's one of his standout performances, as far as I'm concerned.
You know, I've never seen it.
It's really weird.
I still haven't seen it.
It really is. It's been a while since I've watched it. And the second I started thinking about it, I realized I'm due for a rewatch on it to see how I feel about it too. I think the last time I watched it, I was considerably younger, but I'm curious now. Definitely watch it. It's worth your time.
I will do so. I will do so.
Number four, I can't not mention Mace Windu. We can't not involve Star Wars in a list where an actor has played in a Star Wars film. Plus, he's Mace Windu, and I love Mace. Mace is one of my favorite characters, and all of the other facets too, in games and in the books. So Mace, he was fantastic as. My number three is Zoom.
All right, but you have to tell me in which of the, you know, which of the three movies. Okay. You got to pick one of them.
I don't have to.
Yes, you do.
Okay, if I did, then I'm gonna pick Revenge of the Sith. Because it's a catalyst for everything. For everything thereafter.
Yes.
It is that. Okay, so Revenge of the Sith. Specifically, since we have to follow rules.
just so you know, you are so far the first person to choose Mace Windu.
That doesn't on this list. Surprise me. That doesn't surprise me. A lot of people don't like the prequels, and a lot of people didn't enjoy his performance, and they felt it was too much Sam and not enough Star Wars. I thought it was fun, and I loved it, and I loved the character.
Okay.
So I'm for it, but I understand that it's not everybody's fantasy.
Right.
They're wrong. I'm right, but I understand.
Well, that's always with Heather. You know, everyone else is always wrong.
You know what? I don't usually do that. I'm pretty amendable, except on your show. For some reason, I come on here and I draw a hard line. I'm like, let's go.
That's all right. No problem.
I'm really nice, except when I'm not. So you got me in a mood. All right. Number three, Zeus. And part of the reason I picked Zeus and this role in particular, because I think, you know, he has other roles that maybe have stood out more. But I really like that he's just an everyman here. Every man and every woman characters are always my favorite people that rise to the occasion, that are just normal people. Those are my favorite stories. I love them. And he's great in this. And I'm not saying I don't love Bruce and I don't love the whole John McClane scheme and all of that. But I think part of the reason this movie works is because of that dynamic, and it isn't all just chasing John around again. So yeah, so for me, Zeus is a big part of this movie in particular, but I also love Sam's performance. Number two is Mr. Glass from Unbreakable. Again, that goes down to performance, and it goes down to a favorite. It's both. He's absolutely brilliant. And number one is really not going to surprise anybody, but it's Jules Winfield. I love Pulp Fiction. It's one of my favorite movies in the world. I'm a huge Tarantino freak. So I'm not going to shock anybody by saying Jules all day long without even having to think.
Very cool. All right. Excellent. I like your list. So, Heather, would you like to once again tell people where they can find Heather Baxendale?
You can find me at heatherbaxendale.com. You can find my podcast there, Word of Hellmouth. And you can find my book series, The Prophecy. It's a trilogy, and they are all out and available for purchase now. So go ahead and check it out.
All right. And while you're doing that, you can go review and subscribe to me, podcatcher you might be using to listen to the show. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. And if you like sending me an email, you can send one to movierobminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay! Go
marching home again, hoorah, hoorah. We'll give him a hearty welcome then, hoorah, hoorah. The men will cheer, the boys will shout, the ladies, they will all turn out, and we'll all feel glad when Johnny comes marching home.